Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3018, United States of America versus Edward Everett Brown, Jr. Mr. Sussman for appellant, Mr. Guidez for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. As the court well knows, this is a case about Rule 404B, and any 404B case necessarily is fact-intensive, and there's a need to go through some salient facts here. As the court likely knows, Mr. Brown was accused of walking into a Treasury Department credit union, federal credit union, not affiliated with the Treasury Department.
Can I just ask you, is this more of a 403 case than a 404?
Well, actually, it
in the sense that you're not contesting that this evidence was admissible regarding intent, knowledge, lack of accident, mistake, things like that, are you?
Well, I think some of the 404, some of the evidence, especially with regard to the real estate transaction, actually transcended the bounds of 404. Clearly, the 403 analysis is the central point. As I was saying, presented bogus instruments on two occasions to the Treasury Department, the credit union, and while these notes featured certain standard things, routing numbers, things of that, nobody in experienced bankers had ever seen anything like this, and it was pretty clear from the testimony that nobody was ever going to pay any of these notes, and they were purportedly drawn on private accounts that we all maintain with the Treasury Department.
Reasons the district court noted that it was necessary for the government to be able to put some of this evidence in was to show that someone would look at this document and think it was, you know, a legitimate document.
Well, that was the theory with regard to what's known as verisimilitude or similitude, that the document has to bear some semblance to a regular document, and there was either a stipulation or testimony. But there was never a serious issue in the case from a defense standpoint, because in fact the statutory requirement of similitude is met so easily that just standard references like payee, a drawing agent in the sense of it's presented to the Treasury Department, signatures, things like that clearly satisfy that requirement, and the bogus things are just eliminated in terms of the similitude analysis.
I understood part of the argument was that since you were presenting a good faith defense, that basically opened the door for the government.
Well, I think it opens the door and it opens the door to some other crimes evidence, and it's not disputed that the government has some right to bring forward other evidence bearing on the issue of intent. I think that including that kind of evidence doesn't allow anything that even vaguely talks about whether the defendant is a con man, a scam man, someone who's prone to do sharp practice, someone who's prone to bounce a check, pass a bad instrument, lie about a trust fund or something in terms of an English trust who is either buying a property. And the point being that when you place these things seriatim before the jury, the trial becomes far more about Mr. Brown and who he is and what he's prone to do than whether the presentation of these instruments was in fact illegal and whether he had a reasonable belief that they would be honored. I think the court is hitting the point, because I think in essence, we have, and the government faced, a situation where nobody was really, the banks in question, the victims, the purported victim, was never going to pay Mr. Brown. It was clear, you know, in terms of normal banking practices, they're not going to pay out sums of $2.9 million, $5.5 million before they clear. The story itself is ludicrous, that these funds had to be, had to pass through a closed SunTrust bank account. And ultimately, they were never going to give out money that they didn't receive.
That sounds more like an argument about why did the government place charges.
No, it has to do with why does the government want certain kinds of evidence in the case. And this goes to the one of the prejudicial impact of the evidence, because by showing that Mr. Brown goes into a car dealer and passes similar notes and obtains three cars, or the court even allowed evidence concerning a Virginia car dealer in 2004. The government did not adduce that evidence, but that was permitted by the court's order. What the government is allowed to do is establish that Mr. Brown is a menace, that he is actually a danger by virtue of...
Well, I mean, they didn't put in evidence he assaulted anybody or something.
Well, these are financial crimes. I mean...
I mean, my point is there was some connection and relevance to the nature of the crimes charged.
Well, I don't think that's the standard, that there was some connection.
But one of the things that the government had to show was, you know, if it's a good faith defense, then what does he know in terms of the validity of what he's doing or the legitimacy of these instruments that he's trying to use? And at least as I understand the record, part of what happened was after each one of these attempts to pass these instruments where he actually succeeded to some degree, he had a visit from Treasury Department agents basically telling him, you know, these are not legitimate instruments. And that certainly was something valid, right?
That's right. And after the first, that was something the government certainly had to point to in terms of intent. After the first instrument, he attempted to negotiate the first instrument, the credit union, the Treasury agent came to his house, place of business, and said, you can't do this, this is illegal, this is bogus, this is valueless. Brown apparently argued the point with him somewhat, but nonetheless was back several months later with a second note. And that wasn't disputed, that was relevant evidence, and that could come in. And the court's quite right with regard to one of the car transactions. A state agent came.
Is your argument just that it was cumulative? You're not arguing that the evidence shouldn't have come in, just that there was more of it than they needed.
That's exactly the point. And I think if you look at the real estate transaction, which consumed a substantial amount of time. Now, in terms of the proceeds of I believe, the second draft, Brown had asked that those proceeds be wired to a bank in connection with the real estate transaction. Spending money that one obtains is nothing novel and not very probative of anything. And whether one's choosing to buy a $1.8 million home or whatever it was in Maryland or deciding to give it to charity has no probative value from either side. And I don't think that that Brown would be able to adduce evidence that he was intending to gift it or give it away to a charitable organization. I think
let me be clear. I need to understand your argument. You're saying that evidence wasn't relevant and it was cumulative, or it may have been relevant. But it was cumulative.
I don't think it was relevant, and it certainly was cumulative. It was brought in under the heading of motive. Well, anybody who's obtaining money, whether legally or illegally, likely plans to spend it or dispose of it. It's hard to say that spending money, whether you spend it on good things or wasting it or anything in between, is probative of anything. So I would object and believe it was inappropriate to get into why what he planned to do with the funds to begin with, because I think it's inflammatory. Here's a guy going in.
If you were writing the standard, how would you write it?
Well, I'm only writing a standard for this case.
I understand, but, you know, I was looking at Wright and Miller.
Right.
And he's suggesting that, since we're talking about evidence being needlessly cumulative, he says, quote, instead, the question to be asked is whether the evidence on one side is so full that no jury that rejected it would be likely to change its mind because of the introduction of the proffered evidence. In other words, he's saying that it's important that courts not get into questions of sufficiency of the evidence. But rather, he suggests this test. In other words, the Fifth Circuit case that you cited, you know, where the court said abuse of discretion because the photograph was so inflammatory. And that's why I was distinguishing that in this case, there's no evidence that your client was a bad guy because he assaulted people.
No, but...
It's, but I just need to know where you want to draw this line, in the sense that, you know, the district courts, both district courts, were very clear that the evidence was relevant.
I think it's very hard to, the line has to be drawn, I think, on a case-by-case basis. I think that what we've seen in the case decision is that, that one court after another, and I'm talking about the lower courts, rely on the fact that the pronouncement that Rule 404B is a rule of inclusion, and it seems to be a rule of limitless inclusion. And the balancing test that was initially is always required in connection with a 403 analysis is just totally lacking. Even if you look at the court's memorandum or order allowing it, there isn't the type of balancing in terms of any analysis. It's a rule of inclusion. It comes in. In this case, and again, I recognize my time is running short, we got into as much about this real estate transaction as that Mr. Brown did the old, I forgot my checkbook or my wallet trick on when it came time to pay for a home inspection, and that we had this the sight of the real estate agent putting out of her own pocket the $700 for a home inspection fee and reporting sadly that Mr. Brown never paid her back.
So I think, just so I'm clear,
yes, ma'am.
You think the real estate evidence, is it abuse of discretion to allow?
Oh, I think clearly. I think under the four.
I'm going under the categories here.
Well, I think it was I think it was an error from a 404B standpoint, clearly, and then it follows that it was an error from a 403 standpoint.
Right. And you think the purchase of the three cars?
That's a closer question. And the only reason why I think that that may fall into appropriate evidence was because he was warned afterwards, and I think that the government did have a right to show that in negating intent. I think that the other note from to PNC Bank was merely cumulative. It added nothing, and I think that this was designed by the government in a case where there was no harm in the indicted counts, in the sense that Mr. Brown never garnered anything and clearly was never going to get anything, that the government wanted to show that this person is dangerous, is a real criminal, and you need convict him.
All right, thank you. Mr. Vides.
Good morning. John P. Gadez on behalf of the United States. Rule 403, like Rule 404B, is a rule of inclusion, and it does not bar powerful, even prejudicial evidence. There was a substantial probative value to all of the evidence that the government sought to submit, and indeed that was admitted in this case by Judge Hogan.
Mr. Gadez,
yes?
Let me ask you about Mr. Sussman's last point, the $700 payment for the home inspection. Why was that probative?
It was probative in this case because there was a good faith defense that was launched. And indeed, if you look at the opening statement and the closing arguments and the cross-examination of the government witnesses, the thrust of this was on appellate's state of mind and his good faith in believing that what he was doing was permissible because of this House Joint Resolution 192.
But this particular transaction here was just something where he convinced somebody to pay some money for him and he didn't reimburse them, but it wasn't like the other transactions.
Well, it wasn't like the other transactions in the sense that it was the passing of a bogus financial instrument, but it was a part of the real estate transaction scheme, which was to and which was very closely linked to the second credit union financial instrument that was passed in February of 2006. The real estate activities took place in early February of 2006, providing a motive for the subsequent transaction at the credit union in late February of 2006. Now, we know from the evidence in this case that unlike the transactions at the credit union, which appellant tried to persuade the jury were related to his private treasury account that was allowable under H.R. 192 from 1993, appellant tried to get the property in this case through some overseas Arcturus trust, and that the money was going to be wired from some church trust group that was over in in London, and some organization there was going to wire the money. So it was different in that context, but that is all the more probative of the fact that he lacked good faith belief in this HR 192. The failure to repay the real estate agent, in this case the $700, was part of that overall scheme, if you will, involving the real estate transaction. So in that sense, it was probative of his lack of good faith and of his intent to defraud in order to get money that clearly did not belong to him. So,
let's see, 5 of the 8 witnesses were other crimes witnesses, right?
5 of the 9 witnesses were 9? Other crime witnesses.
I don't count 8 witnesses.
There was...
Any idea how many transcript pages?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. The in the second trial, the government presented its direct case in 128 transcript pages. 75 of those transcript pages were direct evidence from the 4 witnesses who testified with respect to the credit union transactions. By my count, approximately 53 pages of transcript were divided up among the other 5 witnesses. And that included 2 witnesses who testified to different aspects of the real estate transaction, 1 witness from PNC Bank, 1 witness from CarMax, and the law enforcement officer who interviewed appellant.
What is the standard here on cumulative evidence?
Well, this court has said most recently, I believe, in the Long case, that it's difficult, if not impossible, for an appellate court to try to determine how much was too much evidence.
There is no limit.
Well, there may be a limit, but what this court has said, is that we're going to leave it in the first instance to the district judge, who's in the best position to assess what potential prejudice there may be from the evidence that is admitted in the case under 404B.
No question about it. But the question is, what do we do on appeal? I mean, what is the standard we apply? Is there no limit?
Abuse of discretion by the trial court. I don't think the court has articulated a standard in terms of how much is too much. Indeed, as I indicated in the Long case, the court has said it's almost impossible to articulate such a standard as to how much would be too much.
It seems to me this case asks us to try our best to come up with a standard where the defense counsel clearly put on the record that the trial was basically going to be about other crimes as distinct from the charged offenses. And the district court, when I looked at the district court's order denying the motion for new trial, he addresses the 403, saying it's not unduly prejudicial, but not the cumulative aspect. And do you see the two as just essentially one and the same, and so that this needlessly cumulative standard that Professor Wright talks about has no role to play?
Well, not necessarily as one and the same, but as in the Douglas case, the district court in this case, because there was a post-trial motion for a new trial on precisely this issue, reconsidered the 404B evidence and specifically addressed the Rule 403 prejudice balancing, and found that it was not unduly prejudicial. Now, the court has stated repeatedly in Douglas and Long and Cassell and Pettiford and Press and many other cases that the evidence is going to be prejudicial. It's the only reason it's coming in is because it's prejudicial. If it wasn't prejudicial, to some extent, the government wouldn't seek to introduce it. But the question is whether it is admitted for a wrong purpose or whether it's unduly prejudicial, unusually prejudicial in the particular case. And in this particular case, the district court did such a balancing case. In this court, the district court found, and I would argue today, not only was this evidence probative, it was substantially probative, given the very forceful defense that was put on that the appellant was acting in good faith, that he was acting
between the first and second trial. As far as this evidence is concerned, was the real estate and the testimony that Judge Brown alluded to, the $700 non-payment of the inspection fee. Is that correct?
The only difference between the first and second trial was the testimony regarding the $700.
Yeah.
Virtually all of the same witnesses.
The real estate agent didn't get to testify.
The real estate agent did not testify in the first trial, but the settlement agent, Mr. Hurd, testified about the transaction and about the bounced $50,000 financial instrument in that case. So the real estate agent testified at the second trial, and the only really new piece of evidence was testimony about the $700. There was also testimony at the first trial with respect to the $50,000 financial instrument. So that instrument wasn't admitted at the first trial. It was admitted at the second trial.
So what do you think the phrase needlessly cumulative is directed at?
That would, in that phrase, needlessly cumulative, would be a piling on of evidence in which it may be that the probative value, there's probative value to the evidence. For example, on the issue of intent, the government has met it and can move on, where perhaps intent is an element that the government has to establish, or knowledge or lack of mistake, but it's not a severely contested issue. In this case, you have to look at, under Rule 403, you also look at the substantial probative value, of the evidence. And in this case, where there was this very forceful defense of good faith, of reliance on this H.R. 192, that he didn't do anything wrong.
Let me just ask you, in a normal case, this is a second trial, so you knew what the defense was going to be. But the government going in doesn't necessarily know what the defense is going to be.
Not necessarily so, although...
What, not necessarily so, which way?
The government may not know how the defense is going to play out, but in this particular case,
I'm talking generally.
Generally.
You knew what the defense was going to be.
Yes.
All right, but in the first trial, when you first started the case, you didn't know what the defense was going to be. So I don't think that you can piggyback, if you get what I mean.
I think we're talking about
needlessly cumulative.
I think in the first trial, I think the government probably had a pretty good idea of what the defense was going to be in view of the
defense. Speculate about that. I mean, the district court ruled in your favor, saying it was relevant, and there were two elements that needed to be shown in particular. I mean, I was just trying to get the analysis. It's not because the defense is going to raise a defense, therefore we get to put in all this evidence. It's what your burden of proof is.
Correct, and the government, in addition to having to prove the acts themselves, had to prove the specific intent to scheme, to defraud the bank, had to prove that these appear to be genuine financial instruments, and the evidence from the real estate transaction, as well as CarMax and the PNC Bank, went directly as proof of the genuine appearance of these financial instruments, in addition to intent, lack of mistake, and a lack of good faith. Thank you.
Is Mr. Sussman's time?
Excuse me. I think the court grasped what happened here, and what really happened was the government tried this case, and the case tried fairly similarly both times. The first time wasn't enough to put it over the top. The second time, the government asked, "What can we add to put ourselves over the top?" And they added the real estate agent who professed only to care about putting people in homes, and here was deceived and undone by Mr. Brown, and apparently the change of chemistry or whatever, or I would submit some additional evidence, did put the government over the top, and I think that was inappropriate.
Sometimes, you know, if you do something twice, you're better the second time.
Sometimes even the third time I get it right, but and the chemistry, granted, changes, but if you're looking for something dramatically different between the two trials, that's what was different.
Namely, the $700 and the real estate.
Well, just the whole chemistry of that kind of thing. Instead of an arm's length business transaction, it became a sequence of deception and personal betrayal by Mr. Brown over these decent people who were only trying to help him find a home. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Sussman, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Brown, and as always, you've done a fine job, and we thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.